Welcome to episode 227 of The Numbers Game. I'm Jace. I'm here with Nick and Marty. And, mate, today, Marty, you've got me really excited because as an accountant, anytime somebody talks about negative gearing or CGT, it is absolutely my time to shine. But it's not my episode. It's your turn to take us through what's got you fired up about negative gearing and CGT.
Oh, well, I love getting you excited, Jace. I know you just go off with this sort of stuff. But, yeah, there's always been this debate and it's coming up in the media quite a bit in regards to, you know, potentially the government scrapping negative gearing or do we keep it? You know, there's always debates around how they can get a bit more money. And had a really good question come in from one of our listeners, Darren McLeod. So big shout out to Darren. And he goes, Marty, hope you're well. Very well, thanks, Darren. Quick idea for you to review. Negative gearing, most people arguing, should we have it or shouldn't we? Attached to residential property. I feel in lieu of removing or dismantling it altogether, we could perhaps scale the system in a different way. So maybe the first property, you get 100% negative gearing, second property, 80%, third property, 40 to 50%. Doesn't mean additional investment properties couldn't be held, just no negative gearing available. So that would limit individuals who have huge portfolios driving up values, yet enabling properties to be wider spread. So I thought it was an interesting concept. I hadn't thought about that because people were talking about scrapping or keeping, and it seems to be the black and white scenario. But initial thoughts on Darren's question, Jace, maybe from an accountant's perspective?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, it's definitely something that's always hot on the topic of conversations with our accounting firm clients around, you know, should they get a property so they can negative gear? You know, if they don't have a property and their mates do, like, they, you know, they're concerned or their questions around, oh, am I missing out? Like, how much am I losing every year by not negative gearing? And then there's always that conversation around, you know, oh, the property's starting to make money now. It's going to screw me at tax time. I probably should sell it so I can negative gear instead. So there's all these misconceptions around, you know, Nick always gets a bit of a laugh out of that one. You know, property's making positive cash flow. I should sell it, you know. Oh my God. But yeah, it's the Australian way is to be obsessed with this negative gearing, or I'm generalizing a little bit there. So yeah, always hear a lot about it. You know, and we're coming up to election time too. You know, it's March 2025 at the moment, but you know, by the time this drops, it might be a little bit later, but we're coming into election time. It's going to be another hot conversation if anyone's brave enough to put negative gearing and CGT back on the agenda. I don't think anyone's brave enough to after what happened a few years ago. One of the governments got completely destroyed for trying to take away negative gearing, and I think franking credits was another one. I think it might have been Bill Shorten potentially back in the day, and yeah, he's not around at the moment, so you can see how badly that went. But yeah, always an interesting conversation, Marty.
Well, I've got some numbers here for Nick from the Parliamentary Budget Office because I was thinking, I wonder what the cost actually is. So these are my weekends going into the Parliamentary Budget Office. How exciting, hey? But they're saying over the next 10 years, the cost of the federal budget is approximately $165.58 billion. Over the next decade. And this is negative gearing would be 100 bill over 10 years, roughly 10 bill annually, and capital gains tax discount 65.46 billion over 10 years, or roughly around about 6.5 billion a year. So in total, 16.5 billion a year. And approximately 2.2 million Australians have claimed rental reductions, with just over 10% of taxpayers, around a million, who negative gear properties. So some big numbers there, Nick.
There is. So by capital gains, you mean the 50% discount? Is
that the discount? Yeah, the discount after you hold a property for 12 months.
Yeah, big numbers, and they're definitely surprising numbers. But I think, that's looking at the issue in isolation, you know, and it's very hard to quantify this, but what are the impacts if you don't have investors, you know, willing to invest in property? It's very hard to quantify that. So whilst, you know, of course it's going to cost, or hypothetically they'll lose that much in revenue, in tax revenue, what are they going to lose elsewhere by investors not, you know, contributing? You know, if the investors don't buy investment properties and don't sell investment properties, then there'll be no capital gains tax at all. So have they thought about that?
Yeah.
So I don't know, there's a lot to think about. the whole negative gearing thing for me, I think it's, I don't know, I think it's a bit of a beat up, to be honest. I think most people that would, if you mention negative gearing to them, they wouldn't even know how it works. And I'm not even joking when I say that. Jase, you'd probably be a better, you'd probably be better to comment on this than I would. But I think what people need to understand with negative gearing is you only get a little bit of your money back after you've already paid out. So
yeah, and that's as long as you've paid tax. That's you have to have paid tax first to be able to get anything back, which is always one that trips people up.
Correct. I don't, and I'll go on a limb here to say I don't think it's the ultimate reason most people invest. I think negative gearing really, where does it really come into play and where is it really beneficial? I think if you've got a new property with depreciation, a lot of investment groups sell off this, where you can then depreciate the value. So you're getting a negative gearing impact on a non-cash expense. That's where it really comes into play. It can have a big difference. But, you know, I just did a quick calc then on an $800,000 property. If you bought that in Melbourne, you're probably 25 grand a year down in cash flow. So if you're 30 cents in the dollar and you can get, you know, $6,000-$7,000 of that back, whatever it is, I don't think that's why people are making decisions. For me, you know, I'm more interested in capital gains and how much you're giving back based on profit. That's what I'm more interested in. I personally, I don't know, I think there'd be a lot of investment groups would hate if negative gearing disappeared, but I think if you're buying good established property, I don't think negative gearing is driving the decision. Just my opinion. I might be disconnected, maybe. I've been some people have said I'm disconnected before on this podcast, but that's my opinion. What do you think, Marty? You've got a lot of mortgage clients. Is negative gearing driving the decision?
I think ultimately everyone's looking for capital growth, and I think what's happened with interest rates going up, I've never particularly liked the idea of losing $10,000 in order to get $3,000 back. Unless the capital growth is substantial, and over the last couple of years, particularly in Victoria, you've sometimes got a little bit of negative growth there. So if you're not going anywhere, I think the driver is always growth, because otherwise why are investors selling so frequently now over the last couple of years? So it's an interesting one. But there's, again, I think I was reflecting on Darren's question, and I just had this brainwave. I think I've solved it for the federal government. And I'm just thinking one investment property, one tax benefit for a better future for all. I think I can run with this campaign and win the next election. I like the concept that one person can have one investment property where you can get the negative gearing benefit and you can get the capital gains exemption of 50% if you hold it for 1 year. Now, that still means if you've got a couple in a family, you have one property each, no problems. But after that, maybe it's more of a commercial decision. And I quite like the idea of people thinking about an investment property very similar to their superannuation, which is more an enforced investment. But if you limit the access, then people go, well, maybe I want to take advantage of that. I'm on a good wage. I want to be in the property market. I can see that people make some wealth through that avenue, and it inspires them to explore that, you know, that individual possibility for themselves. So that was just my train of thought. I think there'd be a wider spread opportunity of wealth, because only about 14-15% of people own an investment property across the board out of the whole population. So it's not like there's a massive take-up either, and it might just educate people or get people to have a look at, well, maybe I want to take advantage of that. And, that was my initial thought anyway.
Well, here's the thing. You said 14% own an investment property. How many own more than one? Do you know that stat?
Well, I do.
Not me.
I've come prepared, Nick. Yeah. So let me give you some more numbers. So of over 70% of property investors, approximately 700,000 to 800,000 individuals, own only one investment property. Around 20% own two properties, and the remaining 10% own three or more, with a small fraction, about 1% of taxpayers, which is 20,000 to 25,000 people, owning six or more. But the interesting stat is the top 1% of investors own roughly 25% of all the investment properties, indicating a concentration of ownership amongst the small group. So if we were to bring the one property in per person, you know, that would primarily affect around about 20 to 30% of investors, around 200,000 to 300,000 people who own multiple properties. So, yeah.
You say those numbers, that's why the $165 billion, that actually baffles me, because one of the big misconceptions about negative gearing, particularly from the younger generation trying to get into property, is that negative gearing benefits the wealthy. And that couldn't be any further from the truth. Negative gearing benefits the mum and dads generally who own one investment property, who are just trying to do something with their cash flow to get ahead in life and provide a better future for their next generation. Most of the wealthy people, I would argue, are sitting on cash flow positive properties because the debt ratio is in there, because I think when wealthy people think about investment properties, they're thinking about, well, if I bought $800,000 property and I got a $25,000 shortfall, what's the opportunity cost of that $25,000? What else could I do that with? Could I do that 25K? I think it's just really the mums and dads. So that's why that $165 billion, that is a real surprise to me, that it's that high. I almost struggle to believe it. Jace, you might have a better understanding here.
Yeah, no, I say statistically, the clients at Future Advisory that own one or two properties are, you know, mum and dads or young couples that have, you know, bought a house early, and then they're trying to use the equity in their home. They've had great growth over the last couple of years, excluding more recently, and they've been able to use that equity to then double down and get a slice of get into their first investment property. But it is realistically, you know, mum and dad investors that are buying one property or two to get ahead in life. I agree. It's not the significantly wealthy people or the wealthier. They don't need to negative gear because they've got positive cash flow. They've got cash reserves. They can pay enough off a property to make it positively geared, and then they're making more money and paying more tax. But where those numbers, Marty, maybe might not do full justice would be, you know, technically I, Jason Robinson, could have an investment property in my name, but also I could set up a family trust with a corporate trustee and buy an investment property through a family trust. So I'd be interested if those numbers for somebody who owns two properties, does that count if the property's owned by, you know, an arm's length trust and a corporate trustee, which we've got quite a lot of investors that are now diversifying their property or able to get access to more money through banks by using a trust to borrow the money as long as it can self-sufficiently service the property. Those numbers are interesting. It does surprise me. And, you know, from an accounting perspective as well, the suggestion that you made about, you know, 100% negative gearing for the first and then scale it back slightly. I mean, look, accountants, we love it when the tax system is more complex. It keeps us in a job. That would make for an interesting way of, you know, doing the tax return, picking which property is going to be, you know, the 100%, and then how to scale it back, and then choosing when to sell. I mean, at the end of the day, as Nick touched on, it's about capital growth for a family that are trying to get ahead in life. You know, diversifying investments, most super funds are probably in managed funds, shares, stocks, Australian stock exchange, and some international. And then if they've bought an investment property in their name, it's their way of diversifying their investments to get ahead in life. So, and then look on those numbers as well. You know, $16 billion a year when our government is rolling at a $1.1 trillion deficit. $16 billion a year is kind of drop in the ocean, realistically. There's some bigger problems overall, but yeah, interesting.
If people don't buy investment properties, the construction market, all these industries that get impacted because people aren't turning property over, not to mention stamp duty at a state level, what impact does that have? Like, you know, you've got to, you can't just say, oh, this is what we lose without looking at the other factors.
Yeah, and they said the the PBO said that 50% of negative gearing benefits go to the top 10% of income earners, many whom own multiple properties. So it's interesting.
That makes sense because they're on a high tax bracket.
Yeah, that
bracket.
Makes sense because they've got the, you know, they've got the ability. But it is an interesting one. I think people that have multiple investment properties sort of think commercially anyway. I think you're right. I think it's one of those things that they'll go into commercial, they'll go into resi, and but they'll see it more as a business transaction. But how do you strip the revenues back to the government and give a wider education to the mum and dads? Because I think a lot of mum and dads never dip their toe into the water, and I think they should. Like, I literally think if they've got the capability to do it, it's a great idea to actually build a narrative to get them into an investment property, of course, if it's affordable for them. But I think a lot of people miss out just for not having a look at it.
What about this for a solution? I've just thought about this.
Go on.
If you want to really look at the net result on a property and whether or not someone's got ahead or not, and tax people for getting ahead, as in getting a win versus a loss and rebating, what if you looked at sale price at the end, less purchase price and get-in costs, less accumulated shortfall to hold the property, and there's your profit. And then you leave it at that. So you're really only paying tax on the – you hold that property for 15 years.
Yeah.
It's cost you $5,000 to $20,000, $30,000, whatever a year it's cost you from a shortfall point of view. You've actually lost that money to hold the property.
Yep.
So you take that shortfall, instead of getting a rebate every year, you take that off your gain, and then you pay a tax rate on the actual gain on the property over a 15-year period.
This is why I love the numbers game washing machine. That is actually really good.
It's simple.
That is really good.
Because then you just got, I made this, but it cost me this. So I'm happy to pay a bit of tax on what I've actually made. But you can't say, the property doubled in value. Well, it did, but you've probably put $150,000 over the last 10 years into it from a shortfall point of view. So it really hasn't made you that because you've had to fund money to keep it.
So you're getting it on the win then after all costs have been expensed.
The actual win. And you can
the actual win itself.
You can do your tax every year and work out what the properties cost you. Like you can, okay, there's the property on your tax return. There's the net loss for the year from a cash flow point of view. There's the accumulated net loss, almost like a business.
Yeah.
And then you get to the end when you sell it and you take that net loss over the last 10 years off the gain, and that's your real gain on the asset.
So you still give the CGT discount after 12 months
no,
as well?
Shouldn't need to, I don't
think. Just kill it off because you don't need it.
It's complicated.
Yeah.
Simple. Money in, money out. This is the gap. Pay tax on the gap, on the pay tax rate on it.
Well, I've only come up with a $70 billion saving over the next 10 years. Nick has just saved the government $165 billion over the next 10 years with that one idea. And I think that's the way to go. I can't beat that one, Nick. I thought I halved it. You've just come in and squashed the whole lot. Fantastic.
Look, there's obviously some things to think about around what if you never sell it? What if it's making a profit? Well, if it's making a profit every year, you're going to pay tax on that anyway. But
yeah,
I just think it's a real simple way to, and a fair way, because this is what I've actually made on the property itself. It's not based on my income and what I earn. So I earn this, so I get a bit more back. It's purely looking at that asset and saying, well, this is what the asset earns over the last 10, 15 years.
Jace, what do you think? Can we take it to Canberra?
I quite like it. I was just running some numbers in the background of, you know, a property over 10 years, what would that look like at an average, you know, loss? And yeah, I mean, it's the numbers stack up pretty nicely. It'd be interesting to actually like kind of multiply it out over scale to see what it would do to the government's coffers. It's an interesting one. I mean, like anything, the things Nick touched on before as well is around, you know, we want to keep our economy propped up and kind of pushing towards into the future. And that does mean, you know, we need more properties. Our population's going up. Australia has a huge amount of land and a lot of people that want to come and live here. So if we're going to keep progressing as a country and as an economy, we need to make sure there's support in place to allow for growth and a prosperous future. So any of these decisions, you know, and this is always the ones that the governments tinker with is around property, you know, first home buyers grants and all these different things. So, but yeah, I really like Nick's suggestion. I think it's brilliant.
Well, I think I was becoming a little bit of a socialist. I was sort of taking from the rich to try and widen the poor. But I actually, in theory, I actually like this a lot more because I think it's a fairer system and, you know, everyone ultimately will win at the end of the day and it'll build awareness as to the benefit of that overall.
I was just going to say, the other thing with negative gearing is it's not concrete. So it's hard to make a decision. Well, you shouldn't make a decision on an investment based on the tax impact because your financial situation and your earnings could change, which will change the tax rebate. So I think if you're making a smart financial decision, you want to know, okay, well, if I'm earning this amount, I get that much back. If I'm earning a less amount, I get that much back. You don't actually know. So I think it makes it more difficult to be certain on the cash flow. And obviously there's other things you're not certain on. What's a rental market do?
On interest rates as well. You know, interest rates have been higher, so the negative gearing benefit paid out is a lot more as well. So you're taking away these issues in the short term and just having a real-time, you know, benefit on the back end. So it just simplifies the whole thing.
I do think, to Jace's point, there needs to be some kind of incentive to get people motivated to build investment properties because of the housing supply issue. So what that looks like, I don't know. But
yeah, I've spent 25 years in finance educating homeowners to buy the first investment property. And it's quite amazing because when I think back over that time, once people know what their capacity is and their capability is and what the longer term prospects of holding property, they will, you know, they will pull the trigger because they know it's doable and workable. But again, like you said, it's the education piece of showing a benefit for people to buy their first investment property is really key, and to put some narrative and incentives behind that like they do for first home buyers. I think that would be absolutely tremendous.
I kind of have a question and a statement, or statement and a question. I think about the amount of money the government's blown over previous years. We've had billions of dollars to wipe out the Commonwealth Games and the East West Link and other different things. There's a billion here and a billion there. You know, this $16 billion a year in negative gearing and CGT discount. Now, just thinking about it, and the question to you, Marty, is going to be, are there other countries that are doing anything that's, you know, mind-blowing and amazing when it comes to properties and affordability and whatnot? But I think about, why isn't the government doing more to build affordable housing that it can own and control? And if you imagine our governments, you know, they're in a deficit, they want to get back to being a rich, wealthy country. And if there's one thing in Australia that generates wealth, it's our property with our property prices. So if our government had built a million homes at $500,000 a pop, using the math's going to be out of whack here, but think about how many homes they could build with the billions and billions and billions they've blown over the years. And then you imagine those properties appreciate in value over the last 5 to 10 years. And you know, let's say property doubles almost every 10 years statistically. How much wealth would that have generated for our economy? And then the rental return on affordable. Yeah, it's just like, what are the options? What are some of the out-of-the-box things that can be done to make a property just better in our country?
And now they're sort of fast-tracking into these super cities with apartment blocks going up 40 stories high as a, you know, as a cheap entry point to try and...
But we have so much land, I just don't know if that's the answer.
Yeah, I
agree. I
don't
know if it's the Aussie way.
I think it's being rushed because the debt's at such a level that they have to find ways to cater for new people coming in, keep the economy rolling. And I think they've probably butchered it with all the debt that they've had, and now they're getting that Band-Aid effect. And whether that's the Australian way, everyone likes their little block of land, is a big question marks over that. But I do like the fact that we might have just wiped out a pig.
Yeah, I think the one that I always get questions on is, you know, why can't I deduct the interest on my home that I live in? You know, my mate in America can do it. So
yeah, that's in the US.
They pay tax on the sale of their property that they live in, so they get to deduct the interest on their mortgage or their home loan. So,
but not on the investment property. Do they claim off the investment, or is it just the owner occ?
All of it.
All of it.
So there's not this main, like we have the main residence exemption, which costs, our, you know, as a cost to the government from a tax collection point of view.
We'd like to keep that too.
You know, we're pretty happy with the main residence exemption. But again, it's just those differences of, you know, what can support a good, healthy economy versus, you know, what is, you know, I guess having a bit of a negative effect to, you know, sustainability and long-term success.
Great points. Negative Nick, gearing.
You punching any maths or numbers? Or are you happy?
No, just playing around with a couple of different purchase prices, and I, you know, just keep coming back to the fact that, you know, negative gearing, it's not a game changer. It's not a game changer, and I think it doesn't drive a lot of people's decisions. As I said, I think on new builds it does because of the depreciation aspect, and you get the negative gearing impact without the cash going out, so that does have a big impact. But I think we mentioned this a few episodes ago, what a lot of people don't understand is that if you do sell, that depreciation gets added back to the capital value, so you don't, that's not actually a benefit. It's a benefit for you to keep it whilst it improves, but you give all that back. So if I look at that being the main driver for a lot of investment groups that sell new properties, the main driver is negative gearing. And a lot of that is resulting from depreciation because it's not a cash cost, and that gets the cash flows right up. I don't think those investment groups would ever talk about the fact that all that depreciation goes back to the capital value when you sell it.
That is a very, very important factor. And we've seen so many clients slip up their own calculations of how much tax they'd need to pay on the sale of a property. And just as an example there, if you owned a property over 5 to 10 years and claimed $100,000 of depreciation, you may have got $45,000 back maximum over 10 years on your tax returns. But again, you can't have your cake and eat it too. If you've claimed a tax deduction for that, what Nick's explaining is it actually reduces the cost base of the value of your property. So if you bought it for $700,000 and $100,000 of that was the building depreciation, the cost base has gone down to $600,000. So if you then sell it for $1 million, it's not $1 million less 700,000, it's $1 million less 600,000, and your gain is 400, and you're going to pay tax on that. So there's always the government's way of getting their money back on, or their hands back on the money. So that's for sure. You've got to watch out for it.
But again, they're giving it to you and they're taking it back. So,
which again goes to show, I mean, yeah, just so many loopholes, so many things to be aware of. And I guess this will come back to the importance of having a good advisor and a good team around you. I know anyone that works with us at Future Advisory and the team at Innovate, these are the questions that are being surfaced. This is the proactive advice that's always being spoken about, you know, when they're looking at property, they're talking about selling, you know, how to invest, what to do. This is the perks of having great advisors in your corner. So thank you for listening. If you have enjoyed this episode, please give us a like, a follow, a subscribe, depending on where you're getting your podcast action from. And until next time,
positive gearing for a positive future, potentially. Thanks, Darren, for the question. Game over.
This podcast is for educational and informational purposes only. The conversations are of a general nature and do not qualify as financial or tax advice. We recommend before you make any financial decisions, you consult a licensed professional. Individuals on the podcast may hold positions in the companies discussed.